We said that tonight we would look at a particular storm, a specific storm that we find in the book of Acts. And so if you want to turn to Acts chapter 27, it's a fairly well-known passage, and it's also a fairly lengthy reading, but I want to read this entire chapter in order to get the whole story and look at what I would suggest along the line of God of the storms. God of the storms. Now remember, this morning we noted three basic facts that we should keep in mind. These are actually applicable to physical storms, but they are especially appropriate when we're considering the spiritual storms that assault us and our spiritual lives. Number one, we said that storms are inevitable. They are going to happen. There's no way to essentially live our lives without storms happening. If we think that we can find somewhere or some conditions or something other than being dead, that storms won't happen to us, that's not real. As long as we're alive, there are going to be storms in our lives. The second thing that we said will always be true is that storms are going to come whether we are ready for them or not. Ready or not. Here lately, the grandkids, when they come to the house, are on this hide-and-go-seek kick. And we've obviously had to lay down some ground rules, and there are obviously some that we should have laid down that we didn't. But everybody knows the drill. You count to however the agreed upon number is. And then at the end of that, you shout out, "Ready or not, here I come." You know, that's the same thing with storms. Ready or not, it's coming. You can get ready for it and make some preparations, and you can handle it a little bit better, a little easier in many cases. But even if you're not ready, it's not going. The other day I was at about 15 and River came running back into my study, which was base. And he said, "Pop, pop, pop, stop. I'm not ready. You're going too fast." So I had to back up and start counting again. Well, you know, that's one of those little nuances of a private game of hide and seek. But the storm, you can say, "Oh, wait a minute. I'm not ready for this storm yet. Stop." No, it's not going to happen, is it? They're going to come, whether we are ready for them or not. And then, of course, the third thing, we said God is not unsympathetic to our difficulties, and God doesn't take joy or pleasure in seeing us suffer, but God is not going to shelter us from the storm if we're not interested in doing what we can to prepare ourselves against them. You know, I believe it would be true to say that in pretty much everything that we deal with God on, He's that way. He wants us to do our part. His part is always so much bigger than ours. His part encompasses all of those things that are beyond your and my abilities. But no matter how small or how insignificant our part is, if we're not willing to do our part, God doesn't have to do His part. Those three facts are very important. But as bad as storms can be, God has a management program. And I think we're going to read about it here in this chapter. And so if you'd like, follow along with me in your Bibles. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. If you'd rather just sit back and listen, I'm going to read pretty fast in order that we can get through this in a good amount of time. Acts chapter 27. This takes place, as you recall, just after Paul has had his audience with King Agrippa. And it's that occasion when Agrippa said, "Paul, almost you persuaded me to be a Christian." And then it was shortly after that time. This is the next part of that story. "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus of Macedonia from Thessalonica. The next day, we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and to be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy, and he put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days, arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salome. Coasting along with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now very dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them saying, 'Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives.' But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. Because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now, when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind called a northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. Behold, God has granted you all of those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island." When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land, so they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little further on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying anchors out from the bow or the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless the men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you've continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." When he had said these things, he took bread, giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. And they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. When they'd eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. This is really a very brief account of about a 2 week long period of a terrible storm at sea. Paul and those who are traveling with him are headed toward Rome. Now, the 276 people on the ship, some translations make that number 76. But most of the reliable translations will show 276 with often a footnote giving the message or the information that there are some translations who render it 76. But whether we're talking about 76 people or 276, that's a lot of people on a boat that's headed toward a crash in the teeth of a terrible storm that just seems to go on and on and on. There are several things, I think, that point out to us God's involvement in this story. And I think it would be safe for us to conclude that the principles upon which God acted in this case are still principles that God uses to guide his dealings today. And so God gives us help in our storms. Whatever the storm may be, whether it's devastating illness, whether it's a diagnosis of something that has no known cure, or a diagnosis that pretty much includes a terribly long time of treatment and rehabilitation, or whether it's some kind of debilitating accident or event in our lives that absolutely changes the way we will have to live from that point on. There are a lot of things like that happen. Automobile accidents, all kinds of events and things that take place that have effects upon us of a very lasting nature. We could just turn our imaginations loose and we could reach into our own background and some of the things that some of us have had to go through, and we could come up with 1,000 good illustrations of what some of the storms in this life will involve. But God has a storm management program. Let me tell you about it. Number one, often when we go through a storm, God puts the right people at the right place at the right time. Did you notice them there when we read this? We come to the first one there in verse 1. When it was decided we would sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. Now, there are at least 8 individual or groups of centurions named in the New Testament, listed in the New Testament. There are 2 whose names we are given. This is kind of an unusual situation here. There really is no great reason for us to need to know that this centurion's name is Julius. Nothing is made of his name. Nothing significant is tied to his name. It's just the fact that the writer tells us about this centurion and gives us his name. Now, you know the other one very well. His name was Cornelius. Cornelius was also a centurion. It's understandable how we could need Cornelius's name, because he's identified by that name in pretty much any conversation that includes the conversions of people in the book of Acts. So far as we know, this centurion was not converted. So far as we know, this centurion never again came in contact with the Apostle Paul after the events that were tied to this storm and this shipwreck. But nonetheless, we're given his name. Pretty much every centurion in the New Testament, and for sure in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is given a very favorable mention by the inspired writers. Now, I find that very significant, in fact, even unusual, knowing what we know about the Roman government and the Roman armies and so forth. A centurion was generally a man who had command over 100 soldiers. A centurion was not only their commander in the field, he was responsible for their provisions, for their food, for their care. He was responsible for seeing that they carried out their orders. But here's another thing. Centurions were often picked and pulled aside and sent out on special duty, sometimes by themselves, sometimes escorting a prisoner, especially a prisoner who had gone through a situation that made him a little bit of a high profile, as Paul was. Julius was there at the right place at the right time, and he was very helpful to the Apostle Paul. In verse 3, it says that a day or two into the journey, they put in at a port called Sidon, and there Julius treated Paul kindly. He even gave him leave to go to his friends there in Sidon to be cared for. Now, what prisoner of the Roman government would be given the privilege of going into a seaport and going to the homes of his friends who happened to live in that place so that they could care for his needs? The right people at the right place at the right time. Oh, and don't forget Luke. You notice this chapter is written in the first person. we should sail for Italy, verse 1. Verse 3, the next day we put in at Sidon. Paul's not writing this. Luke is writing this, and it is a fact that there were times and occasions in the things that are reported in the book of Acts that Luke was there and he wrote from the first person standpoint. There were some times when Luke was not there, and it's obvious by his wording as he refers to they and them doing certain things. But here it's we in this chapter. It didn't dawn on me until right now, you could do this later, to count up all of the times that Paul mentions Luke in his letters to other churches, Luke being with him or Luke being sent to a certain place. Suffice it to say that Luke was a very valuable helper to Paul. And Luke is permitted to go along on this journey. The right people, at the right place, at the right time. And of course, verse 2 tells us that Aristarchus was also with him. Aristarchus, who Paul mentioned as being his fellow worker and companion when he writes the letters to the church in Colossae and also to one of the members of the church there, Philemon. Paul mentions Aristarchus, who was from Thessalonica. The right people, the right place, at the right time. Let me ask you something. Could you look at this particular point only from the standpoint of thinking about who God is going to put in my life and at my disposal and who God will make available to me when I have a storm? Wouldn't it be better to also as well look at it from the standpoint of how can I let God use me to help someone else through the storm? God will not only provide the right people at the right place at the right time, but God can also use us as the right people at the right place at the right time. And we need to give that some careful consideration. Secondly, consider the fact that often God warns us away from the stormy circumstances through the wise counsel of those around us. How many times in my life have I received good, wise advice, and how many times did I keep going full speed ahead without paying attention to what someone advised? Look down here at verses 9 through 11. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion, and I have to conclude that's Julius, the only negative thing that's said about him in this chapter. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot, the captain of the ship. I mean, who should we listen to? The guy who's driving this thing and the owner of the ship. Not unusual for the owner of a vessel to be included and along on the journey. They paid more attention to them than to what Paul said. Think about all of the good advice that we've allowed to go unheeded that resulted in us being tangled up in some pretty significant storms in our lives. in Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 15. The wise man says something to the effect of, "The foolish man always thinks he's right, and the wise man listens to the counsel of others." There's tremendous wisdom in that, isn't there? Sometimes good counsel can even come from the prisoner. Sometimes good advice comes from some really unexpected places. Now, I'm not saying, and you know I'm not saying, that we need to be open to anything anybody ever suggests, any wild plan that somebody else has, any kind of scheme. No. But we need to consider carefully, because how do we know that God hasn't, through His providence, allowed that message to be delivered to us through those who are near to us? And the third thing that I want to suggest that God does for us and helps us out of our stormy situations is the fact that every possible device of His providence will be used for our good. Every possible device of God's providence will be used in accomplishing His will. Now that causes me to want to slow down for a minute and think about all of the things, all of the power, all of the ability that God has, that He can work with and enact through His providential care. We can't even begin to understand God's providence, much less see and understand the boundaries of it. Just knowing that God in His providence promises that all things work together for good to them who love God, them who are the called according to His purpose, Romans 8 and verse 28. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 is another passage that assures us that our God is able to do beyond what we even know how to ask for. So those are three ways, three things, three parts of God's storm management program. Before we close, let's take a quick look at one other thing, and that is the fact that often storms can be for our good, even when they involve unpleasant, difficult, painful, or hard things. There can be good in them. You know, the honest truth is, sometimes storms help us to clear the decks. You see, one of the crucial elements in this story was the fact that in order for the ship to go as far as it did, they had to get rid of all of that valuable cargo. In fact, even going to the extent of throwing overboard all of the ship's tackle, a lot of the rigging that was not being used at the moment to manage the sails. How many times have you been through a storm? And often, I'll admit, it's afterward when we look back at it, we realize that it was a good occasion for getting rid of some things that we had no business holding on to begin with. Often, it takes a storm to show us just how powerless we are. Because we live in a very Well, we live in a very motivated culture. Self-motivated. I know a lot of people look like nothing could motivate them, but we live in a very self-sufficient culture. Let's put it in that term. You know, sometimes it takes a good dose of hardship and difficulty to show us just how dependent we are on God. And then, of course, the storms will often remind us that God is always right. What was it Paul said when he told them, verse 25, "So men, take heart, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told." It will be exactly as I have been told. It will be exactly as we have been told. We can abide by it. We can reject it. We can laugh at it. We can embrace it. All kind of options out there. But the bottom line is, it will be exactly as we have been told. In Psalm 119, along about, I believe, verse 71 or so, David said, "It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn your statutes." In other words, hardship gives us an opportunity to get closer to God and to come to better terms with His will for our lives. Pretty good storm management program. It worked for Paul. It'll work for us. If you're subject to our Lord's invitation in any way, we invite you to respond as we stand together and sing this song.